Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have a report on how unmanned aircraft, or drones, are being used to fight poaching in the African country of Tanzania. We will have more on that story later in the program. But first, shopping centers, stadiums, and universities may soon have a new tool to help fight crime. A California company called Nightscope says its robots can predict and prevent crime. Nightscope says the goal is to reduce crime by half in areas the robots guard. William Santana Lee is the chief executive officer of Nightscope. He says these robot security guards will change the world.
Our planet has 7 billion people on it. It's going to quickly get to 9 billion people. The law enforcement apparatus and security apparatus that we have globally is just not going to scale.
Mr. Lee says his company's autonomous data machines can become the eyes and ears of law enforcement.
You want it to be machines plus humans. You know, let the machines do the monotonous, computational, heavy, and sometimes dangerous work, and let the humans do the strategic decision-making work, so it's always working in tandem.
The machines are 1.5 meters tall and weigh 136 kilograms. They do not carry weapons, but have day and nighttime video cameras able to turn 360 degrees. Mr. Lee says they can also sense chemical and biological weapons. Eugene Volokh is a law professor at the University of California. He says the machines have to be used in the right way. He says some people may become concerned about their privacy, especially in connection with the video recordings. Some people may worry that such recordings will appear on the internet. Mr. Volokh says it will be interesting to see how state laws deal with this kind of surveillance video. William Santana Lee says there is a long waiting list for the robots in the U.S. At least 25 other countries are also interested in these robotic security guards. You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Conservationists are struggling to stop people who illegally hunt or catch animals, such as rhinos and elephants. They are now using DNA identification and drones to follow animals in the wild and help protect them from poachers. Marcia James has more.
Africa's fight against poaching is often described as a war. Illegal killing is on the rise, fueled by growing Asian demand for ivory and rhino horn. Experts estimate that more than 35,000 African elephants are killed every year, and rhino poaching is thought to have reached its highest levels. African conservationists no longer rely on simple foot patrols. South Africa is already using surveillance drones to monitor its wildlife in national parks. Kenya plans to do the same. The fight against poaching is a modern war, and it is becoming increasingly high-tech. A small white airplane, the DT-26, flies into the skies over the Selous Game Reserve in Tanzania. The plane is a drone, and its designers hope it will soon be used to catch poachers. Mike Chambers runs Bat Hawk Recon, the company that made the drone. He says that right now, Tanzania's rangers do not have the resources even to keep up with poachers.
With a quarter of a million square kilometers of protected area, it's impossible with the budget that Tanzania has to cover that area effectively. The resources available for rangers just aren't going to be able to do it, especially at the moment where the resources for poachers are rising because of the international demands.
Mike Chambers says his drones cover large areas that otherwise would be impossible to watch. Drones are a technological tool that can greatly reduce poaching and give park officials more help.
Drones give a multiplier effect to rangers. If we can cover 4,000 or 5,000 square kilometers with a pod of drones, then fewer rangers are needed to cover that area because they can be organized as a reaction force and to go where we've found the incidents to be occurring.
In neighboring Kenya, the Wildlife Service is focusing on genetics to strengthen legal cases against poachers. Last month, the service opened a lab in Nairobi where suspected bushmeat can be identified. Philip Maruthi is chief scientist for the African Wildlife Foundation. He says that along with ivory poaching, illegal bushmeat hunting is also reducing Kenya's wildlife population. Until now, charging those who hunt or catch game illegally has been difficult. Poachers often claim giraffe or zebra meat is beef, and proving otherwise can be difficult.
Often, law enforcers in the wildlife area lose their cases because they cannot authenticate. They can't prove it in a court of law that that which they are using as exhibit is actual prohibited wildlife material.
Maruthi says the new lab should be able to tell the kind of animal the meat comes from. The lab also will be able to provide a genetic database of Kenya's endangered animals. The information can help charge ivory and rhino horn poachers.
When you find samples from anywhere in the world, you can take those samples and match them to your database and be able to say where the confiscated item comes from. So if you are trying to nail somebody in a court of law, you can say, well, this is something that you are trafficking illegally.
Conservationists point out that technology is only as good as the people behind it. They say that Africa's endangered animals still depend on the political will to protect them. That desire, they say, is sometimes lacking. I'm Marcia James.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. The United States and Iranian officials meet in Vienna for a final round of talks on Iran's nuclear program. However, a top U.S. official says negotiators may not reach an agreement by the time limit of June 30th. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif are planning private discussions in the Austrian capital. Others expected to take part in the talks are the P5 plus one nations. They are the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council and Germany. The U.S. official said negotiators remain committed to the June 30 deadline, but talks may continue beyond that date. The official added that all parties in the talks want to get a good agreement. But Obama administration spokesman Josh Earnest said there are no immediate plans to extend the deadline beyond Tuesday. Iran reached a framework agreement with the U.S., Russia, China, France, Britain, and Germany on April 2nd. The agreement would permit inspections of nuclear sites and place limits on Iran's ability to enrich uranium, which can be used as fuel for a nuclear weapon. In exchange, Iran would receive relief from international sanctions. However, negotiators are still working on details of the plan. One debated issue in negotiations is when sanctions will be lifted. Iran wants an immediate end to sanctions if an agreement is reached. The restrictions have seriously hurt the country's economy. Other countries involved in the negotiations want sanctions to be removed in steps over time. They also want a process to verify that Iran is observing the agreement. The two sides also disagree over inspections of suspected nuclear centers. Iran's spiritual leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said Iran will not permit international inspectors to see military sites, scientists, or documents. He spoke Tuesday on state television. He rejected limitations on the country's nuclear research and development lasting 10 to 12 years. And he demanded that sanctions be lifted upon signing the deal instead of in stages. In previous statements, the religious leader had expressed support for the talks. Secretary Kerry answered, saying the Iranian leader's comments were not new. He said, "What matters is what is agreed upon within the four corners of the document. That is what is yet to be determined." Mr. Kerry added that if Iran fails to abide by the framework agreement reached in Lausanne, Switzerland, there will not be an agreement. Former Ambassador Jeffrey James is one of several former officials to sign an open letter expressing concern the agreement may not be a good one. Five of those officials have served in the administration of President Obama. Mr. Jeffrey said those who signed the letter are concerned the administration will offer too many concessions. They urge tough inspections, long-term limits on nuclear research, full information on Iran's past activities, and a gradual reduction in sanctions. Mark Fitzpatrick of the International Institute for Strategic Studies said, "The comprehensive deal, if and when it is struck, needs to be clear and detailed as to what is allowed and what's not allowed." And that's In the News. I'm Mario Ritter.
Now, the weekly special English program, American Stories. Our story today is called To Build a Fire. It was written by Jack London. Here is Harry Monroe with the story.
The man walked down the trail on a cold gray day. Pure white snow and ice covered the earth for as far as he could see. This was his first winter in Alaska. He was wearing heavy clothes and fur boots, but he still felt cold and uncomfortable. The man was on his way to a camp near Henderson Creek. His friends were already there. He expected to reach Henderson Creek by 6 o'clock that evening. It would be dark by then. His friends would have a fire and hot food ready for him. A dog walked behind the man. It was a big gray animal, half dog and half wolf. The dog did not like the extreme cold. It knew the weather was too cold to travel. The man continued to walk down the trail. He came to a frozen stream called Indian Creek. He began to walk on the snow-covered ice. It was a trail that would lead him straight to Henderson Creek and his friends. As he walked, he looked carefully at the ice in front of him. Once he stopped suddenly, and then walked around a part of the frozen stream. He saw that an underground spring flowed under the ice at that spot. It made the ice thin. If he stepped there, he might break through the ice into a pool of water. To get his boots wet in such cold weather might kill him. His feet would turn to ice quickly. He could freeze to death. At about 12 o'clock, the man decided to stop to eat his lunch. He took off the glove on his right hand. He opened his jacket and shirt and pulled out his bread and meat. This took less than 20 seconds, yet his fingers began to freeze. He hit his hand against his leg several times until he felt a sharp pain. Then he quickly put his glove on his hand. He made a fire, beginning with small pieces of wood and adding larger ones. He sat on a snow-covered log and ate his lunch. He enjoyed the warm fire for a few minutes. Then he stood up and started walking on the frozen stream again. A half hour later, it happened. At a place where the snow seemed very solid, the ice broke. The man's feet sank into the water. It was not deep, but his legs got wet to the knees. The man was angry. The accident would delay his arrival at the camp. He would have to build a fire now to dry his clothes and boots. He walked over to some small trees. They were covered with snow. In their branches were pieces of dry grass and wood left by floodwaters earlier in the year. He put several large pieces of wood on the snow under one of the trees. On top of the wood, he put some grass and dry branches. He pulled off his gloves, took out his matches, and lighted the fire. He fed the young flame with more wood. As the fire grew stronger, he gave it larger pieces of wood. He worked slowly and carefully. At 60 degrees below zero, a man with wet feet must not fail in his first attempt to build a fire. While he was walking, his blood had kept all parts of his body warm. Now that he had stopped, cold was forcing his blood to withdraw deeper into his body. His wet feet had frozen. He could not feel his fingers. His nose was frozen too. The skin all over his body felt cold. Now, however, his fire was beginning to burn more strongly. He was safe. He sat under the tree and thought of the old men in Fairbanks. The old men had told him that no man should travel alone in the Yukon when the temperature is 60 degrees below zero. Yet here he was. He had had an accident. He was alone. And he had saved himself. He had built a fire. Those old men were weak, he thought. A real man could travel alone. If a man stayed calm, he would be all right. The man's boots were covered with ice. The strings on his boots were as hard as steel. He would have to cut them with his knife. He leaned back against the tree to take out his knife. Suddenly, without warning, a heavy mass of snow dropped down. His movement had shaken the young tree only a tiny bit, but it was enough to cause the branches of the tree to drop their heavy load. The man was shocked. He sat and looked at the place where the fire had been. The old man had been right, he thought. If he had another man with him, he would not be in any danger now. The other man could build the fire. Well, it was up to him to build the fire again. This time, he must not fail. The man collected more wood. He reached into his pocket for the matches. But his fingers were frozen. He could not hold them. He began to hit his hands with all his force against his legs. After a while, feeling came back to his fingers. The man reached again into his pocket for the matches. But the tremendous cold quickly drove the life out of his fingers. All the matches fell onto the snow. He tried to pick one up, but failed. The man pulled on his glove and again beat his hand against his leg. Then he took the gloves off both hands and picked up all the matches. He gathered them together. Holding them with both hands, he scratched the matches along his leg. they immediately caught fire. He held the blazing matches to a piece of wood. After a while, he became aware that he could smell his hands burning. Then he began to feel the pain. He opened his hands, and the blazing matches fell onto the snow. The flame went out in a puff of gray smoke. The man looked up. The dog was still watching him. The man got an idea. He would kill the dog and bury his hands inside its warm body. When the feeling came back to his fingers, he could build another fire. He called to the dog. The dog heard danger in the man's voice. It backed away. The man called again. This time the dog came closer. The man reached for his knife, but he had forgotten that he could not bend his fingers. He could not kill the dog because he could not hold his knife. The fear of death came over the man. He jumped up and began to run. The running began to make him feel better. Maybe running would make his feet warm. If he ran far enough, he would reach his friends at Henderson Creek. They would take care of him. It felt strange to run and not feel his feet when they hit the ground. He fell several times. He decided to rest a while. As he lay in the snow, he noticed that he was not shaking. He could not feel his nose, or fingers, or feet. Yet he was feeling quite warm and comfortable. He realized he was going to die. Well, he decided, he might as well take it like a man. There were worse ways to die. The man closed his eyes and floated into the most comfortable sleep he had ever known. The dog sat facing him, waiting. Finally, the dog moved closer to the man and caught the smell of death. The animal threw back its head. It let out a long, soft cry to the cold stars in the black sky. And then it turned and ran toward Henderson Creek, where it knew there was food and a fire.
You have just heard the American story called To Build a Fire. It was written by Jack London and adapted for Special English by Donna DeSanctis. Your storyteller was Harry Monroe. For VOA Special English, this is Shep O'Neill.